Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your question in the comment box. You can also call in by listening or call to listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click POH Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our first guest is Nathan Richardson, who is a spoken word artist and Frederick Douglass reenactor. He penned the article January 20th, 2021, Should Not Be 1863 All Over Again. That is in the current issue of Port of Harlem. Welcome, Nathan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. Wonderful. Brand new day in America. Yeah.
Well,
glad to be here with Port of Harlem. Yes.
Well, I have to admit that I'm a great fan of what you write, and in your latest article, it helped make me have a brand new day. So let's talk about you, the article, what you have to say. Yeah, and for our listeners, of course, Frederick Douglass lived through the Civil War and Reconstruction era, which was to have laid the Confederacy to rest, but of course it did not. Nathan, you write, referring to the Confederacy quote, "We should be spending our energy to end the ideology, not just take down the symbols." Do you want to get us started by explaining that further?
Yes. Well, you know, I tell you what, long before, I have to change this. I've been doing Frederick Douglass for the last 7 years. This is my 7th year of portraying Frederick Douglass. And I started out by saying, in this journey, long before I found Frederick Douglass and started doing Frederick Douglass, I had to change that after about 3-4 years, because I soon realized that Frederick Douglass had found me. And so, but long before Frederick Douglass found me, I really had this concept of that the symbols of racism in America are really just markers. It's part of the structure and the infrastructure of racism in America. And to take those markers down would leave us blind, and blinder than we already are, as to, what to avoid. If you read the article, that manifested itself around 87. I was managing a National Guard armory in Suffolk, Virginia, and this president of the NAACP came into my office, and he was demanding that one of the 26 flags that we had hanging on the wall on the drill floor, which was a Confederate flag, he wanted it taken down. You know, he was very adamant about it. And I understood his point of view, but I also realized that, you can take the flag down, but the ideology is still there. And so I gave the example in the article that that very day that we were speaking, they were breaking ground on a new shopping center, supposedly to help one of our, less wealthy communities, public housing communities, with a new shopping center and a new grocery store. Well, in addition to this grocery store, they were putting a liquor store in this shopping mall, and that's, just the image of that in your mind, that somebody in a housing community, a public housing community, can walk one block to the liquor store, means real trouble. So, if we're gonna spend our time fighting racism, fighting the structure of racism in America, we need to do some tangible things,
So for clarity point, I'm assuming that you're not So are you saying that we should leave the flag alone, or we should do the flag alone, or we should take the flag down and deal with the ideology, or only deal with the ideology?
All of the above. If you're gonna take the flag down, then deal with the ideology, but don't take the flag down and have the false assumption that you've made some major accomplishment. Because later on when I started studying Frederick Douglass, and I'm reading one of his speeches. This speech is A Friendly Word to Maryland. And he went to Maryland in 1865 after they had abolished their constitution and abolished slavery. And he gave this speech in which he told the people in Maryland at that speech, now that the monster of slavery is dead, let the shadow and the substance go down together and let them sleep forever in a common grave. So when he said the shadow and the substance, he meant the flag and the root of the flag, right?
Or the ideology,
right?
The ideology.
Yes.
That's your bigger point. That's your bigger point. And
yes.
I appreciate that. But you also wrote that America rails against those who kneel when the national anthem is played, but are silent about those who fly the Confederate flag. I took that to mean that white people in general and others have accepted descent to what they perceive as whiteness as a sin, and that to include diverse white descent is noble. Am I missing a point?
No, you're not missing it at all. And this is, again, part of what Douglass fought against. He started out as an abolitionist. Once the Emancipation Proclamation was drafted by Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War ended, then the abolitionists had to find out, you know, a new career or how to change their strategy. Well, this strategy, he just shifted to Reconstruction, which was designed to bring people along into full enfranchisement into the society, the government, et cetera. And so there were lots of money, I mean, troops even, that were allocated in Reconstruction to enforce all the things that Reconstruction was supposed to do for African Americans. But unfortunately, the backlash of that was pushing back. And so what he was trying to do was to end the romantic narrative that the South would rise again. It's this romantic narrative that has been going on since the Civil War, that it was a noble cause. And even that it was not even about slavery.
You're right.
Which we all know that's false.
Right, and that's what I meant to explain myself a little bit more, is that it seemed as though, not only then, but in my other experiences, is that when white people do something that's bad or not good, somehow it gets romanticized or becomes acceptable
right.
as being, they're being diverse. And when I read that, the first thing reminded me of being in school in Iowa. And on Wednesdays, when the white boys thought that it was their right to go and get drunk and to come back and just make the dorm look horrible, and people would just say, well, that's what they do. I was thinking, if that's what
right.
they do, as if that's normal.
Boys having fun, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what
so,
I think about
so
when I think about
this,
Reconstruction, is
yeah.
that the boys were having
yeah.
fun. And that now it's okay
right.
to bring the white boys back in at the expense of black people.
Right. Right. So what we have witnessed in this last, 4 years, and specifically in the last 4 months, are some extreme contradictions that have been televised for the entire nation and the world to see. So number one, I mean, if you want to go back to civil rights, the March on Selma, the Pettus Bridge, that was by design to show the contradiction. King was well aware of that. Now, by happenstance, the same thing happened with George Floyd. 8 minutes and some seconds, almost 9 minutes, that we saw the contradiction vividly, and it woke a lot of people up. And then again, because, you know, right now America does not even believe, you don't even believe what you say, and you hardly believe what you see. But when they saw that Capitol, and they actually had a memory, their memory had not disappeared, that when Black Lives Matter was there, that fence, the 10-foot fence that's there now, was there before Black Lives Matter reached the Capitol.
Right. But
many people calling me saying, why didn't they have the fence up there? I had people from D.C. that called me, white people from D.C. that called me and said, I saw that. I actually saw that because I was here in the city before Black Lives Matter came, and there was a 10-foot-high fence up there.
Yeah, but Nathan, you're saying that. But Nathan, you're saying that people woke up. I don't know if they woke up, because even today, when Biden ended the Muslim ban, my first thought, and we posted it on our Facebook page, is why were we afraid of the Muslims in the first place, and why are we afraid of the African Muslims from Sudan in particular? we should be afraid of these people right next door to us. They're the ones who went to the Capitol.
It's because, of course, that a certain segment of the far right are basically they're okay, and I think I alluded to this in the article. They're actually not Republican, and they're actually not conservative. Now, I know they're not Republican.
Let me read the words you put. Let me read the words you wrote. You put the primary participant.
Okay.
And another short sentence you expressed. The primary participants in the 2021 election are facts, in caps, Confederates.
Right.
That's what you're looking for.
And we know that because they were carrying a Confederate flag. And we know they're not Republicans because, number one, there were no Confederates in the Lincoln Party, in the Party of Lincoln. How can you call yourself the Party of Lincoln, who emancipated the slaves, who actually had, who did not have Confederates in that party? They were in the Democratic Party, right? So this goes all in line with this whole false narrative that the Civil War was not about slavery, that it was a noble cause, that we're actually denying that the Civil War was about slavery. We're denying that in the 50s, the Dixiecrats moved from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party as a shift from the North to the South, labor, right, a labor shift. So they deny this all the time. And so, unfortunately, what has happened is that Trump and the Internet has given voice and allowed that ideology of white supremacy to take hold in the Republican Party and really just put it in a situation where it's, you know, they don't even believe facts are no longer acceptable to them.
Well, I guess you already answered my question. How do you connect the 2021 insurrectionists with the 1863 Confederates? So we can move on to another question, too. I think along those same lines. Yeah, I think so, too. I think along those same lines, you wrote, quote, likewise, dangerous is the idea that the Confederacy was a noble cause or the romantic narrative of the South will rise again. And you was talking about that a little bit, but why don't you go ahead and talk about that a little bit more?
So one of the things that I do in my portrayal of Frederick Douglass, I would invite the listeners to, find my next performance and come online and ask questions or come to the live performance. If you come to the live performance and we ever get into a conversation with Frederick Douglass and we start talking about, you know, the value of the United States Constitution versus the Confederate Constitution, Douglass is not going to be playing with you. He has a copy of the United States Constitution in his breast pocket and a copy of the Confederate Constitution in his back pocket. And so even if he is talking to Civil War, you know, daughters of the Confederacy, when they start talking about this idea that it was a noble cause and that the Civil War was not about slavery, then what we're going to do is really just pull out the document and take a look at it. The thing about the United States Constitution, and Douglas said this, is that there is neither the term slave, slaveholder, slave master, or slave state in the Constitution. Those words are not there, but they are ambiguous. So when they say people, the definition of people had not been defined until the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. Those amendments were needed to define the term people, because henceforth people was ambiguous that according to them only meant white men. Now you have the cloak of anonymity under the United States Constitution, and you're not satisfied with that. So you decide to secede from the United States Constitution, and you write a constitution that literally has the word slave in it. How can you deny that? You can't deny it.
So that's what's in the Confederate Constitution.
Article 4, verse 1, Article 9, verse 3, the term slave is written into the Constitution. So you're telling me on one hand that it's not about slavery, but you took the time to write slavery into your Constitution.
So that's interesting. Never heard that before in my life. So I'm glad you brought that up. Never. Now you're making me want to go look at a Constitution, at a Confederate Constitution. So you just gave me another thing to do. Thank you.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit before we get back to the question about the article. So let's talk a little bit about you being a reenactor. You know, for some people,
yeah,
including myself at one point, I probably would have thought that a reenactor was a person like a person at Disney World, that you put on a costume and walked around and shook people's hands. But obviously that's not the case.
Yeah.
So how much time do you spend reading about Douglas and visiting the places where he's been, et cetera?
Yeah, I tell you, when I was deciding on if I was going to do Douglas, I actually had to make that decision, because you're right. There are people who do King, and the only thing they do is just like on King Day, they recite the "I Have a Dream" speech. You know, they put
exactly.
on a tie and a, you know, and that's pretty much all they know. There are people who just do the character as a photo op, as a reenactment, and they shake hands. But when I decided to do it, I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to fully commit, which means that it basically has, I had to cut my creative writing time in half and devote at least half and sometimes all of my energy into studying Frederick Douglass, reading his books, his letters, newspapers, all of that. I actually spent the first year not even reading anything, any biography written by another author. Now, I got this advice from someone else. Do not read anything that Frederick Douglass says that someone else says about Frederick Douglass, because he has 3 autobiographies, his own newspaper, hundreds of letters. Why do you need to read somebody else's opinion when he is giving you his identity? And so that's
gotcha.
What I did. Right. I spent the first 3 years just studying Douglass himself. Fortunately, poetry, spoken word, gave me the tools that I needed to be able to memorize and recite, you know, his speeches and poems and everything. So that's how I developed the character, and so I spent a lot of time. I mean, his first narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, I'd probably listened to that book on audiobook probably 60, 70 times.
Wow.
So because what I want to be able to do is when someone is sitting in the audience with an iPad or their cell phone Googling questions, I want to be able to answer the question.
And I could attest that from time to time, at least once I could say so far, that I've had someone present me some information supposedly about Douglas, and I reached out to you, and you gave me an answer in 5 minutes, and I appreciate that. A little bit shocked the first time, but now I feel better.
Yeah. But there are a whole group of great people out there who do the same thing or at the same level. And I tell you what, this is how I know. I mean, I have ran into, I'm going to give this lady a shout out because I'm getting ready to do a performance with her, Tubman and Douglas, Janice Custis Green out of Maryland.
Okay.
I ran into her at the Douglas Banneker Museum. We had never seen each other before. And we did 15 minutes just off the cuff, ad lib. She knows the character forward and backwards. She knows the relationship between Douglas and Tubman, and I know the relationship. So we don't have, it's no rehearsal required. You just know, you become that character.
Well,
and she's an outstanding Harriet Tubman. Yeah.
That would be interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you have those type of events, of course you let us know at Port of Harbor so we can include it in the activity section of the magazine, which comes out every other week, and send free to people who are subscribers. Yeah, we'd like to do that.
Right. Yeah.
And you also wrote, I got to chuckle out of this one. You also wrote, quote, for those so daring to make a claim of independence from the established government, remember, history only awards the title of patriot to winners. And what you were saying is that people who are going around saying they're Confederates and storming the Capitol and saying they're patriots, they really got something incorrect. So I wonder why they choose to remember to think why. I wonder why they think they choose to only remember that they are not winners. And that why they forget that they're losers. And what do you think about them not remembering that they actually lost the war?
Well, it's part of trying to claim nobility. It's part of them trying to claim that noble tag. And so they say they are patriots. But, you know, well, I tell you what, in 1776, they start out calling themselves patriots, right? Now, the only reason we still call them patriots, or even that, you know, Britain, England refers them to patriots in the history books, is because they won their independence. If they had been slaughtered, they would not be considered patriots today. They would be traitors. And so the same is true of January 6th. How can you be a patriot when you caused an insurrection and you lost miserably? That's not a patriot. That's a traitor. And hopefully these people will be treated as traitors. They will be prosecuted
as traitors. And I meant not only them, but the people who fought the Civil War, their ancestors, or to me, their blood, either their blood or their spiritual ancestors. They lost in 1863, and you made that clear. So for those who haven't read the article, he makes that clear. But why even the people who keep holding on to this notion that there was a lost cause or noble cause, or that the Confederates were patriots, are they holding on to that notion for the same reason as these modern Confederates, in your opinion?
I think it really goes a little bit deeper than that. It's really kind of a human nature to clean up the life of our relatives, even if they die, you know, for a bad cause. I mean, I was telling somebody just the other day, right down the house from my parents is the church I grew up in. If you go behind the church, my family plot is there. Now, there are a whole bunch of people who died, lived a great life, and I can say they're noble people. But there are some people laying there. They're there simply because of the mistakes they made, right? So am I just going to, like, open to the public, you know, so-and-so, you know, he was my cousin and he was a scoundrel and a rat and he got, you know, no, that's not what people do. That's not what anybody does, really, right?
Right.
This is on a mass scale, though. This is on a mass scale that we have a whole generation of people who are trying to protect, you know, the reputation of their ancestors. So it's really, you know, that part of it is pretty simple. you know.
Yeah,
but
said,
you know, we so, you know, I do meet, you know, in my circles of Frederick Douglass and doing, I mean, I actually go and talk to Civil War roundtables. And I tell you what, most of the people who really look at the history seriously do not try to present this noble cause. Because when you do start reading it, you're going to read the Confederate Constitution, and you know for a fact that it was about slavery. So
yeah,
you continue to represent Robert E. Lee, and you tell the story. You tell the good and the bad of the person, and you try to educate people, young people especially, about, you know, the pitfalls of history.
I've had some experience with that, with going to the Confederate White House by mistake in Richmond, and that was an experience for the lady to try to clean up things, and into the one in Montgomery, where they try not to make it so bad. But I will tell you, if you haven't been to one of those things, I think it's great to go to, because it really cleans your shocking senses as to what people can come up with.
I think most of it from the broader perspective is really just a lack of knowledge of the history. You know, just that you have read certain parts of history and then you make certain assumptions. I mean, there's a lot of false assumptions about Douglass. People cherry pick Jesus Christ. I mean, they pick the scripture that they want that serves their agenda for Jesus Christ. So what do you think they're going to do with Douglass? What do you think they're going to do, you know, with Robert E. Lee? They're going to pick the verses, the quotes that support their narrative or what they believe, you know.
Okay, so let's end with hopefully with your last one. Let's end with another one quote of yours. You said, hopefully the inauguration on January 20th, 2021 will mark the beginning of a 21st century reconstruction and the completion of the once thwarted after the Civil War. After Biden's first couple of hours, do you feel that hopeful now?
Well, I'm a very, very optimistic person. Number one, I really believe I'm not a fortune teller. I actually was not surprised that this happened. You know, I actually think it was probably necessary for it to happen. I think that Biden is going to do the best he can, but it's not up to Biden. I actually was finishing up a piece when you printed this story here. I was finishing up last Saturday, actually an essay, which talks about it from an optimistic point of view. And the title of this essay, which I'm going to be releasing this week, it's actually too long for an op-ed. It's 1,200 words. But the title of this essay is The Five Things That Saved American Democracy. The Five Things That Saved American Democracy. And I'm just going to give you the five, and you're going to have to read the essay or listen to the YouTube to learn, you know, to get my breakdown. But the five things are, number one, the woman. The press, number three, the judicial system, number four, corporate citizenship, and number five, love. Those are the five things that have saved our democracy in this particular point in time. All of those things stood up, and they stood up and spoke truth to power. They stood up one by one. Even when I had doubt in the judicial system, even when I had doubt in corporate America, they stood up and said, enough of this BS.
Right? Gotcha. Well, we're going to end this 30-minute conversation.
That's why I'm optimistic.
Okay. So, again, Nathan Richardson, you can find him on portofharlem.net. He has at least one article and a couple of quotes by now. And if you need to get in touch with him, of course, you can get in touch with us if you can't find him. But you do want to give your number or your web address before we leave?
Yeah. My web address is www.s as in spiritual, c as in concepts, publishing.com, scpublishing.com. You can actually Google my name, Nathan Richardson, poet, and you can find me. And my phone number, if you want to call me, is 757-535-1505, 757-535-1505. I'd love to talk to you.
Okay, so again, Nathan, thanks so much for the conversation. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with our next guest. Thanks a lot, Nathan.
Thank you for keeping the Black Press alive.
All right. Thanks so much. All right.
All right.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with our next guest. And our next guest is Dr. Theo Hodge Jr. Are you there, Theo?
Yes, I am, Wayne.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Hodge is one of our regular contributors. He's also been involved in the fight against HIV for decades now. And he's also a public speaker in public education in a number of HIV forums. And today we want to ask you a couple of questions about the whole notion of the relationship between HIV and COVID. In particular, I want to start off asking you, when you were in medical school, can you remember your professor ever talking to you about or preparing you to live and work in two pandemics in your lifetime, such as the ones we're living with now, HIV and COVID-19? And how has this newest pandemic been for you personally as a medical professional?
Well, I can tell you, certainly as a medical professional, I in practice, as you are aware, and I have a very large primary care practice, and I also do infectious diseases, so I am very passionate about the treatment of people living with HIV as well as the prevention of HIV. But as a general practitioner, my practice has been affected by COVID, and so not only have I had patients hospitalized and a couple in the ICU, I have also had two people pass who would not have passed had this syndrome not been around. And it was very, I can tell you, it was very upsetting. It was very draining because, you know, I was very much a part of these people's lives and having to watch them go from afar because they were locked away in a retirement village and nobody could see them, no one could come near them. And I dealt with their families as they tried to cope with the loss of their loved ones. So for me, this has been it's been rather draining from a physician standpoint because it's my job, you know, as a physician to be there for my patients and offer emotional support and direct them to places that they can get additional support if need be. And it's been a lot. Generalized anxiety in my practice has gone up dramatically as a result of this pandemic. I've had people lose 1, 2, 5 members of their family. So, yeah, this is a very angst-provoking event in our history.
But when you look,
I have been. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But also, when you look back at it, you have lived or are living through two pandemics. Does that ever make you feel like, wow, what is going on with my time on Earth?
Well, you know, I often have said, wow, really? I mean, I've been done with a boring life with none of these things going on, but here you have it. I mean, the two pandemics are similar in that they can affect any and everybody. There are some dissimilarities. I mean, certainly with the COVID-19 pandemic, one can go from living to dead in 2 weeks. That typically, if one is first infected with HIV, that doesn't occur in 2 weeks. In general, from the time of infection to the time, and this is only if you do not take any steps to treat HIV, It takes about 10 years to go from being HIV infected to living with AIDS. And that's for the majority of people. It takes about 10 years. Obviously, there are some people where that happens much more quickly. And then there are those few people who are infected with HIV who have seemingly had no effect on their immune system. And we're not sure if it's because the virus was a weak one or their antibodies were that much better. So there lies the difference between these two pandemics. One can just take you out in no time. The other one, at least you have a little bit of time to do something about this. And so with that, you know, that's one of the major dissimilarities I know. But the major similarity, as I said before, it can affect both of these pandemics can affect anybody.
I understand that, but from your perspective as a human being, when you think about all the times you could have been born and been a doctor on Earth, and you're like, this is my time that I'm a doctor on Earth.
Well, you know what, Wayne? The way I look at it in terms of how I've always looked at my time here practicing medicine. You know, I look at my practice as a ministry. And as these things come up, hey, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be, you know, doing what I can to enhance patients' quality of life to the best of my ability. And that includes my years of experience and my education. So regardless of what has happened and regardless of, you know, the fact that it's not easy to do this, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, that's interesting. Good perspective. Huh, never thought about that way. But when it comes to prevention messaging, though, maybe you could give me some more thought on this one. When it comes to prevention messaging, it appears that either people have failed to hear or government and health officials have failed to properly share the needed message. Is there a lesson to be learned from the HIV awareness and prevention campaign that you wish were being used in COVID awareness and prevention campaigns?
So, you know what? I am a scientist. I'm a big believer in science. It's how I actually practice medicine. I, you know, determine what options my patients have based on science. And we talk about these things. And recognizing that sometimes science is not going to really provide an answer. But to the best of your ability, at least it's been my teachings through medical school and my personal experience, science has provided great options for patients to consider as we talk about addressing their medical concerns. So in terms of the two epidemics, awareness is a big deal. And as you are well aware, with HIV, as people became aware of how one gets HIV. I mean, back in the day, people thought that, you know, if you kiss somebody, you could give them HIV. If you touch them, you could give them HIV. People...
They walk into your house.
Right. Exactly. All of these things that scientists, you know, and observation and studies, eventually you found out how you actually can get HIV, and there are 5 bodily fluids. There's blood, there's semen, there's vaginal fluids, there's pre-cum, there's breast milk, and sometimes people include anal fluids. So you know that you can kiss somebody, you can lick them, you're not going to get them HIV. You can touch them, you can hug them, you're not going to get them HIV. But with COVID, that kind of awareness has come much more quickly than it did with HIV. So we recognize that with COVID in terms of actually contracting the virus, which is the severe acute respiratory distress syndrome virus, coronavirus number 2, that's the virus that actually causes COVID, really respiratory droplets that we think is a major way of which this virus is transmitted. And that's usually going to be transmitted, you know, when someone coughs and you actually are within 6 feet of them. Which, you know, this is why we have the CDC recommendations of social distancing. If you can be 6 feet away from somebody, you can wear your mask, you can, you know, wash your hands, avoid touching your, your mouth, your eyes, your nose until you've had a chance to wash your hands and or use hand sanitizer. This should dramatically decrease the likelihood that you will come up with COVID. And, yeah, sometimes, you know, COVID may actually live on the surface. But, again, if you touch the surface and then use hand sanitizers or wash your hands, this will definitely decrease the likelihood that you'll be walking around with COVID. And, you know, again, in terms of awareness, we are well aware that particularly with COVID, there are health concerns that will put you at an increased risk of having horrendous complications with COVID. And that includes hypertension and asthma and heart disease and being overweight and being over 65. These are some of the things that will put you at an increased risk. With HIV, in terms of, you know, there are certainly sexual activities that would put you at an increased risk. And, you know, not wearing a condom is one of them. So, again, we have become aware of how these viruses are transmitted, and we're also aware of ways in which we can prevent actually acquiring the virus, coming down with the ultimate in terms of HIV. It would be AIDS, and with COVID, it would be symptoms and being in the hospital, being on a ventilator, and then being in somebody's grave. So those are the ultimate things that can happen with either of these viruses. So
okay, but
COVID,
so okay, so we know, so that's a good summation of the information we need, but is there something we should learn from the HIV campaigns that we should be applying to the COVID campaigns?
It's called science, Wayne. If these people are actually, I mean, the problem is that COVID was politicized. So you had a group of people who said, why should you wear a mask? And you had a group of people saying that COVID was a hoax. And, I mean, I still hear this. I still hear this.
I know. I have a relative who had told me he didn't even believe it.
Right. I mean, the disinformation is just stunning. And, yeah, I have to admit that I have been astounded as not only a physician, but just as a person that somebody would say up in my face that COVID was a hoax. I'm like, and to get this, because as an African-American provider, I remind my patients that COVID, as well as HIV, disproportionately affects. So in terms of COVID, I have actually had educated, as in I have my degree from an Ivy League school. I've had people say to me, well, you know, really, no, it's Caucasian people who are most affected by COVID. And when I pointed out in the literature and in the paper, and this actually happened, I'm telling you. When I said this to one of these people who was saying that it's not really in the African-American community, it's really Caucasians, and I said, well, what about all of this literature that says it's, you know, we're dying, we're the people that are dying. They said, well, you know, those black people hung out with white people. That's how they died. I'm like, wait a minute, hold up, really? Am I really hearing this? And they were serious. And I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. There are rarely times that my mouth drops to the floor, but that was one of them. So
okay.
This is the type of
I guess you said the big difference is that it's still that with COVID, it's hard to translate the HIV campaigns because the COVID campaigns have been so politicized.
Well, that's right, because the HIV campaigns were all based on science. So were the COVID vaccines, the COVID campaigns. They were based on science. But unfortunately, politics interfered with the messaging. So,
gotcha.
You know, the CDC is telling you all of this stuff based on science, not because of something they made up, and you have someone else saying that, number one, the virus doesn't exist. Why would you wear a mask? You need to get back to work. I mean, people are dying. Okay?
Gotcha.
400,000 plus people are dead from this virus.
Let me go to the next question. While new HIV infection rates have declined, STI infections are rising exponentially. So that indicates that people are not using condoms. If you had to set policy, what would you want to do to get people to follow good health practices, such as wearing condoms and wearing masks and getting tested for STDs and COVID-19?
Okay, so again, this is all about providing information. You know, after, you know, doing this for nearly 25 years, I've told, you should wear a condom, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, patients look at me like, that's cute, Dr. Hodge. And I give them condoms, and they throw them over the corner. I mean, I used to give people cherry, licorice condoms, banana-flavored condoms. I had all these condoms. People would just look at me and smile sweetly and throw them over in the corner. So I'm like, okay, well, here's the deal. This is what I, as a healthcare provider, have come to terms with. An HIV infection, particularly for these patients who are in the younger age group of me. So, you know, I'm about to turn 60 this year, and my cohorts remember people dying. They remember being 25-year-old and having three of their friends die. Remember going to the clubs, and they're like, oh, so-and-so ain't here no more. Or you might see somebody and go, wow, you're still alive. People still remember that sort of stuff. But these 30-year-olds, they're like, oh, you know, Dr. Hodge, people in your generation died, not in mine. So, you know, why should I wear a condom? If I get HIV, I'll just pop a pill and be on my way. So, you know what? You know, I've come to terms with that, and I say to them, look, any of my patients coming in with HIV, I tell them up front three things. Learn what you need to learn, do what you need to do, and go live your life. And for the most part, people who are living with HIV will live just as long as someone not living with HIV. But here's the bottom line. That living that same life has a few more obstacles in it than someone not living with HIV. You got to take medication every day. Who knows if that medication is going to work? There are potential adverse side effects. And remember, I can't cure you of HIV. So that means the virus is still there. You may be undetectable, but the virus is still there. So what does that mean? That means that there are particular medical concerns that are much more likely to happen in people living with HIV, such as heart disease and kidney disease and liver disease. In fact, people who live with HIV tend to have these things happen 10 to 15 years earlier than someone who is not living with HIV, even if they are undetectable. So I remind people there is a reason not to get HIV. So then people look at me and go, okay, well, let's talk about prevention. And then we talk about PrEP. So they're like, okay, I'm taking PrEP. I'm preventing an incurable infection. Yes, I might be having and coming to your office with gonorrhea and chlamydia and syphilis. But again, I'm being real with you, Wayne. I can cure gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. I can give you a pill or a shot, and they're gone. I can't do that with HIV. So sometimes I have to, again, I give all the information about the use of condoms. We talk about PrEP, and PrEP is a big deal. So if I get the person on PrEP, I, as a healthcare provider, say to myself, at least if they don't use condoms, 99% of the time, because you know PrEP is not 100% effective. It isn't. What is? And I tell them that you should be using PrEP or condoms. But 99% of the time, I'm preventing an incurable infection. So even if they still walk up in my office with an STI, most of the time I can cure them of that STI. And they're not walking in with HIV. So that's what I had to come to terms with as a provider.
Okay, does PrEP cause the same side effects as having HIV?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
There's a big difference between walking in with HIV and PrEP. PrEP is pretty, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, there as with any drug, there are potential adverse side effects. And I remind people all the time, because they're like, oh, you know, these pills, you can take a Tylenol and in a subset of the U.S. population, their liver will stop working and they'll need to have a liver transplant. Does that happen very often? No. But there is a subgroup of people who have, you know, this enzyme deficiency, and their liver stops working after a single Tylenol. I've been in the hospital and seen it happen. Obviously,
gotcha.
That does not happen very often. But, I mean, you know, typically these drugs are very tolerable. They're very tolerable, and they certainly are much easier to deal with than actually having HIV infection. So in terms of prevention with HIV, that's what I've had to deal with in terms of wearing condoms. In terms of prevention of COVID, put the mask on, okay? And now that we have a vaccine, that's the other huge preventative measure. Hello? So know, I'm just saying, because I've gotten a lot of my patients looking at me sideways going, and you know they bought that vaccine out there. How do you know that vaccine going to work if people live with HIV? How do you know it's not going to interfere with my medication? I'm like, hello. This virus was what? Brought to our attention in December of 2019. It is now a year later. Do you really think anyone has had time to do all of these studies on all of these different patient populations? They've done general, asked people to be in the studies, and people have had, let's take the Moderna vaccine. There's two vaccines.
Yeah, because that's what I'm going to, I guess in particular what you're talking about, whether or not they've taken, I guess you're answering, that was my next question, actually, but you're answering the question for me of whether or not having COVID affects people with HIV.
If you have AIDS, let's say your immune system is compromised and you have T cells below 200, then of course you are much more likely to have complications of COVID were you to actually contract it. And you will probably be that much more easily infected if you are really immunocompromised. Most of my patients, though, don't have T cells below 200. Their immune system is relatively intact. And yes, HIV, people living with HIV will probably have a slightly increased risk of complications. But most of my patients walking around with HIV have, T cells way up there. They've been undetectable for years and years. They're going to be just fine. And I've spent a lot of my time reassuring my patients, you are going to be fine. You need to practice the CDC recommended measures to prevent yourself from walking in my office with COVID. But no, I'm not expecting you to be that much more likely to come down with COVID. And for the most part, that has been very true in my observations over this past year. I have not had loads of people walking in my office who are living with HIV and have COVID.
So have there been formal studies, or these are your observations? Have there been formal studies on how COVID affects people?
These are my observations, because there really hasn't been any formal studies specifically looking at just the group of people living with HIV. In the trials, which the Moderna trial was like 30,000 people in that trial, and 25% of people were over the age of 65, and about 25% of them had some increased risk factor, which included diabetes, hypertension, and yeah, there were some people living with HIV. So, I suppose one could look at that subgroup of people, but in general, it was only, there were 30,000 people who were thought to be at risk of acquiring COVID that went into the study. So you didn't have people who were just locked away in their house, never seeing anybody, and, unlikely to have COVID. And in, at least the Moderna trial, 95% of patients actually developed antibodies. And when they looked at, who developed COVID? Well, in the placebo group, because this was a double, randomized placebo-controlled trial, so you didn't know if you were getting the vaccine or not, and supposedly the investigator didn't know if you were getting the vaccine or not. Of course, you had to unblind the trial at some point. And they found that people who got the salt vaccine, there was like 185 people who ended up with COVID. Those people who got the actual COVID vaccine, only 5 people ended up with COVID. But those 5 people, none of them died. Like, none of them. So everybody.
Yeah, I was reading that yesterday. Yeah, I was reading that yesterday. And just to slow that up for some people who may not have followed you, that you were saying that half the people got a fake peel, put that way. And the other half got the real peel. And the most of the people with the real peel didn't get sick. Right.
That's the scientific way. That's the only way that you can know for sure whether or not something works, is you have to do those kind of trials. I mean, it's usually a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blinded trial. So randomized, you flip a coin. You're either going to get the real drug or not. Placebo-controlled, that means that one of those things is a sugar pill, the other one is real. And double-blinded means you don't know what you're getting, and neither does the investigator. So that way you don't introduce bias, because if you knew you had the vaccine, you might be running around with your mask off in front of thousands of people because you're like, I'm protected. So you can't do that. You need to not know what you have so that you can figure out, you know, exactly, you know, how this is going to be affecting you. So that's what we usually do. Now, unlike HIV, that epidemic, as we know, it probably began a lot earlier, but, you know, what we know, it's around 1981. We did not have effective therapy until 1996. So 1981 to 1996, we had people dying right and left. Now, what happened is that ACT UP, which is a group of white gay men, jumped up and said, you people have lost your minds. We cannot wait years and years and years for you to come up with a drug. Okay, so people need to hear me on this. Back in the day, it took years for a drug to come, or a vaccine, or anything to actually be approved. And when HIV was going on, the white gay men said, you people have lost your mind, you need to come up with something now. So, like within 6 months, AZT was approved. Next month, when it took years for other drugs to be approved, AZT was put out in 6 months because people were dying. They were like, you need to give me something right now. Well, as you can imagine, this vaccine, again, way faster than any drug we had for HIV. So it's nice that we don't have to wait that long before we have something that actually can prevent possible infection and possible demise. So there again, a huge difference between the HIV pandemic, where 1981 is when we think it started, and 1996, when we had our first effective therapies. Here we are, it was, what, January 2021, and again, that virus was first identified in Wuhan, China, in December of 2019.
Yeah, we all
That's
know Wuhan.
Pretty rapid for us to come up with something.
So I guess in short, what you're saying is that really the ACT UP, the gay activists, white gay activists in particular, and ACT UP actually helped the FDA changed its process, which helped people to get this new vaccine within a year, as opposed to where when HIV pandemic, it took almost a decade.
Exactly. More than a decade, 1981 to 1996. But you're right. It took 1987 was the first drug. It just wasn't effective. But that was the first drug that we had. So that took, what, 6 years later? I mean, it wasn't effective. We didn't have effective therapy until 1996. I mean, really now. So I think we've come a long way. I mean, obviously, no one has all the answers. I can't tell you if you take this vaccine, you know, I know you'll produce, for most people, they produce antibodies. I don't know how long they'll last. I don't know, you know, if does that prevent you from transmitting the virus. I don't know any of these answers. My patients who ask me questions like, well, does it interfere with my medications? I'm like, well, what vaccine do you know interferes with your medication? I mean, when you get a flu vaccine, do you think that interferes with your medication? Some of the stuff you're like, okay, at least based on what you know from the past, it's unlikely that this vaccine is going to have these effects on you. Now, again, I haven't descended from the heavens, you know.
So you don't know everything, right?
I don't. I mean, people do that to me. I'm like, no, I don't know if I'll grow a third eye in 2 years after I get this back.
We only have 60 seconds left. So what we're going to have stuff another time for you to talk about what's happening new with HIV and also see what happens with the COVID virus as people get more shots. So let's have another conversation before the year's out or before the summer happens.
I look forward to that, Wayne. Thank you so much for having me as a guest on your show.
But thanks so much for all the background information and for the explanations and for the real-life drama.
It was my pleasure.
And I'm glad you survived the drama.
Because
oftentimes we forget that medical personnel are humans too. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. And don't forget to check us out at portofharlem.net. Thanks a lot, Dr. Hodge. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.